fingertips had been steadily deteriorating in the cold air. I tramped out of camp by headlamp, behind Rob and Frank, wending between ice towers and piles of rock rubble to reach the main body of the glacier. For the next 2 hours, we ascended an incline pitched as gently as a beginner's ski slope, eventually arriving at the Bergschrund that delineated the Khumbu Glacier's upper end. Immediately above rose the Lhotse face, a vast, tilted sea of ice that gleamed like dirty chrome in the dawn's slanting light. Snaking down the frozen expanse as if suspended from heaven, a single strand of 9mm rope beckoned like Jack's beanstalk. I picked up the bottom end of it, attached my Jumar to the slightly frayed line, and began to climb. Note: a Jumar, also known as a mechanical ascender, is a wallet-sized device that grips the rope by means of a metal cam. The cam allows the Jumar to slide upward without hindrance, but it pinches the rope securely when the device is weighted. Essentially ratcheting himself upward, a climber thereby ascends the rope. End of note. I'd been uncomfortably cold since leaving camp, having underdressed in anticipation of the solar oven effect that had occurred every other morning when the sun hit the western coom. But on this morning, the temperature was held in check by a biting wind that gusted down from the upper mountain, creating a wind chill that dipped to perhaps 40 below zero. I had an extra pile sweater in my backpack, but to put it on, I would first have to remove my gloves, pack, and wind jacket while dangling from the fixed rope. Worrying that I was likely to drop something, I decided to wait until I reached a part of the face that was less steep, where I could stand in balance without hanging from the rope. So I continued climbing, and as I did so, I grew colder and colder. The wind kicked up huge swirling waves of powder snow that washed down the mountain like breaking surf, plastering my clothing with frost. A carapace of ice formed over my goggles, making it difficult to see. I began to lose feeling in my feet. My fingers turned to wood. It seemed increasingly unsafe to keep going up in these conditions. I was at the head of the line, at 23,000 feet, 15 minutes in front of guide Mike Groom. I decided to wait for him and talk things over. But just before he reached me, Rob's voice barked over the radio Mike carried inside his jacket, and he stopped climbing to answer the call. "Rob wants everybody to go down," he declared, shouting to make himself heard above the wind. "We're getting out of here." It was noon by the time we arrived back at Camp 2 and took stock of the damage. I was tired, but otherwise fine. John Taskey, the Australian doctor, had some minor frost nip on the tips of his fingers. Doug, on the other hand, had suffered some serious harm. When he removed his boots, he discovered incipient frostbite on several toes. On Everest in 1995, he'd frostbitten his feet badly enough to lose some tissue from a big toe and permanently impair his circulation, making him particularly susceptible to cold. Now this additional frostbite would make him yet more vulnerable to the cruel conditions of the upper mountain. Even worse, however, was the injury to Doug's respiratory tract. Less than 2 weeks before departing for Nepal, he had undergone minor throat surgery, leaving his trachea in an extremely sensitive condition. This morning, gasping lungfuls of caustic snow-filled air, he had apparently frozen his larynx. "I'm fucked," Doug croaked in a barely audible whisper, looking crushed. "I can't even talk. The climb is over for me."
"Don't write yourself off just yet, Douglas," Rob offered. "Wait and see how you feel in a couple of days. You're a tough bastard. I think you've still got a good shot at the top once you recover." Unconvinced, Doug retreated to our tent and pulled his sleeping bag over his head. It was rough seeing him so discouraged. He'd become a good friend, unstintingly sharing the wisdom he'd gained during his failed attempt on the peak in 1995. Around my neck, I wore a Zai stone, a sacred Buddhist amulet blessed by the Lama from the Pangboche Monastery that Doug had given me early on in the expedition. I wanted him to reach the summit almost as badly as I wanted to reach it myself. An air of shock and mild depression hovered over the camp for the remainder of the day. Even without unleashing the worst it could dish out, the mountain had sent us scurrying for safety. And it wasn't just our team that was chastened and doubtful.
Morale seemed to be at a low ebb for several of the expeditions at Camp 2. The bad humor was most apparent in the bickering that broke out between Hall and the leaders of the Taiwanese and South African teams over sharing responsibility for stringing more than a mile of rope that was needed to safeguard the route up the Lhotse face. By late April, a line of ropes had already been fixed between the head of the Coombe and Camp 3, halfway up the face. To complete the job, Hall, Fisher, Ian Woodall, Makalu Gao, and Todd Burleson, the American leader of the Alpine Ascents guided expedition, had agreed that on April 26th, one or two members from each team would join forces and put ropes up the remainder of the face, the passage between Camp 3 and 26,000-foot Camp 4. But it hadn't happened as planned. When Ang Dorje and Lakpa Chiri from Hall's team, guide Anatoly Bukharev from Fisher's team, and one Sherpa from Burleson's team departed Camp 2 on the morning of April 26th, the Sherpas who were supposed to join them from the South African and Taiwanese teams stayed in their sleeping bags and refused to cooperate. That afternoon, when Hall arrived at Camp 2 and learned of this, he immediately made some radio calls to find out why the plan had broken down. Kami Dorje Sherpa, the Sirdar for the Taiwanese team, apologized profusely and promised to make amends. But when Hall raised Woodall on the radio, the impenitent South African expedition leader responded with a barrage of obscenities and insults. "Let's keep it civil, mate," Hall implored. "I thought we had an agreement." Woodall replied that his Sherpas stayed in their tents only because nobody came around to wake them up and tell them their assistance was needed. Hall shot back that Ang Dorje had in fact tried repeatedly to rouse them, but they had ignored his entreaties. At that point, Woodall declared, "Either you're a bloody liar or your Sherpa is." Then he threatened to send over a couple of Sherpas from his team to sort out Ang Dorje with their fists. 2 days after this unpleasant exchange, the ill will between our team and the South Africans remained high. And contributing to the sour mood at Camp 2 were disturbing snippets of news we received about Nawang Topche's worsening condition. As he continued to grow sicker and sicker, even at low altitude, the doctors postulated that his illness was perhaps not simple HAPE, but rather HAPE complicated by tuberculosis or some other pre-existing pulmonary condition. The Sherpas, however, had a different diagnosis. They believed that one of the climbers on Fisher's team had angered Everest, Sagarmatha, goddess of the sky, and the deity had taken her revenge on Nawang. The climber in question had struck up a relationship with a member of an expedition attempting Lhotse. Because privacy is non-existent in the tenement-like confines of base camp, the amorous assignations that took place in this woman's tent were duly noted by other members of her team, especially the Sherpas, who sat outside pointing and snickering during the encounters. "X and Y are sauce-making, sauce-making," they would giggle, miming the sex act by pumping a finger into the open fist of the other hand. But despite the Sherpas' laughter, to say nothing of their own notoriously libertine habits, they fundamentally disapproved of sex between unmarried couples on the divine flanks of Sagarmatha. Whenever the weather would turn nasty, one or another Sherpa was apt to point up at the clouds boiling heavenward and earnestly declare, "Somebody has been sauce-making. Make bad luck. Now storm is coming." Sandy Pittman had noted this superstition in a diary entry from her 1994 expedition posted on the Internet in 1996. April 29th, 1994. Everest Base Camp, 17,800 feet. The Kangshung Face, Tibet. A mail runner had arrived that afternoon with letters from home for everyone, and a girly magazine, which had been sent by a caring climber buddy back home as a joke. Half of the Sherpa had taken it to a tent for closer inspection, while the others fretted over the disaster they were certain that any examination of it would bring. "The goddess Chomolungma," they claimed, "doesn't tolerate jiggy-jiggy, anything unclean on her sacred mountain." Buddhism, as it is practiced in the high reaches of the Khumbu, has a distinctly animistic flavor. The Sherpas venerate a tangled melange of deities and spirits who are said to inhabit the canyons, rivers, and peaks of the region. And paying proper homage to this ensemble of deities is considered crucially important to ensure safe passage through the treacherous landscape. To appease Sagarmatha, this year, as every year, the Sherpas had built more than a dozen beautiful, meticulously constructed stone chortens at base camp, one for each expedition. A perfect cube 5 feet high, the altar in our camp was capped with a triumvirate of carefully selected pointed stones, above which rose a 10-foot wooden pole crowned with an elegant juniper bough. 5 long chains of brightly colored prayer flags were then strung radially from the pole above our tents to protect the camp from harm. Note: prayer flags are printed with holy Buddhist invocations, most commonly Om Mani Padme Hum, which are dispatched to God with each flap of the pennant. Often prayer flags bear the image of a winged horse in addition to written prayers. Horses are sacred creatures in the Sherpa cosmology and are believed to carry the prayers heavenward with special speed. The Sherpa term for prayer flag is Lung Ta, which translates literally as wind horse. End of note. Every morning before dawn, our base camp Sirdar, an avuncular, highly respected 40-something Sherpa named Ang Chering, would light sprigs of juniper incense and chant prayers at the Chorten. Before heading into the icefall, Westerners and Sherpas alike would walk past the altar, keeping it always on the right, and through the sweet clouds of smoke to receive a blessing from Ang Chering. But for all the attention paid to such rituals, Buddhism as practiced by the Sherpas was a refreshingly supple and non-dogmatic religion. To stay in Sagarmatha's good graces, for instance, no team was permitted to enter the icefall for the first time without first undertaking an elaborate puja, or religious ceremony. But when the frail, wizened lama slated to preside over the puja had been unable to make the trip from his distant village on the appointed day, Ang Chering declared that it would be okay for us to climb through the icefall after all, because Sagarmatha understood that we intended to perform the puja very soon thereafter. There seemed to be a similarly lax attitude concerning fornication on the slopes of Everest. Even though they paid lip service to the prohibition, more than a few Sherpas made exceptions for their own behavior. In 1996, a romance even blossomed between a Sherpa and an American woman associated with the IMAX expedition. It therefore seemed strange that the Sherpas would blame Nawang's illness on the extramarital encounters taking place in one of the Mountain Madness tents. But when I pointed out the inconsistency to Lobsang Jangbu Sherpa, Fisher's 23-year-old climbing Sirdar, he insisted that the real problem was not that one of Fisher's climbers had been sauce-making at base camp, but rather that she continued to sleep with her paramour high on the mountain. "Mount Everest is God for me, for everybody," Lobsang solemnly mused 10 weeks after the expedition. "Just husband and wife sleep together is good, but when X and Y sleep together is bad luck for my team. So I tell to Scott, 'Please, Scott, you are leader. Please tell to X not to sleep with boyfriend at camp 2. Please.' But Scott just laughs. The first day X and Y in tent, just after, Nawang Topche is sick at camp 2. So he is dead now." Nawang was Lopsang's uncle. The two men had been very close, and Lobsang had been in the rescue party that brought Nawang down the icefall on the night of April 22nd. Then, when Nawang stopped breathing in Faraday and had to be evacuated to Kathmandu, Lobsang rushed down from base camp, with Fisher's encouragement, in time to accompany his uncle on the helicopter flight. His brief trip to Kathmandu and speedy trek back to base camp left him quite fatigued and relatively poorly acclimatized, which didn't bode well for Fisher's team. Fisher relied on him at least as much as Hall relied on his climbing Sirdar, Ang Dorji. A number of very accomplished Himalayan mountaineers were in attendance on the Nepalese side of Everest in 1996. Veterans such as Hall, Fisher, Brashears, Pete Schoening, Ang Dorji, Mike Groom, and Robert Schauer, an Austrian on the IMAX team. But 4 luminaries stood out even in this distinguished company. Climbers who demonstrated such astonishing prowess above 26,000 feet that they were in a league of their own. Ed Viesters, the American who was starring in the IMAX film. Anatoly Bukharev, a guide from Kazakhstan working for Fisher. Ang Babu Sherpa, who was employed by the South African expedition, and Lobsang. Gregarious and good-looking, kind to a fault, Lobsang was extremely cocky, yet hugely appealing. He was raised in the Rawaling region, his parents' only child, and he neither smoked nor drank, which was very unusual among Sherpas. He sported a gold incisor and had an easy laugh. Though he was small-boned and slight in stature, his flashy manner, appetite for hard work, and extraordinary athletic gifts earned him renown as the Dion Sanders of the Khumbu. Fisher told me that he thought Lobsang had the potential to be the second coming of Reinhold Messner, the famous Tyrolean alpinist who is far and away the greatest Himalayan climber of all time. Lobsang first made a splash in 1993 at the age of 20, when he was hired to carry loads for a joint Indian-Nepalese Everest team led by an Indian woman, Bachendri Pal, and largely composed of female climbers. Being the youngest member of the expedition, Lobsang was initially relegated to a supporting role, but his strength was so impressive that at the last minute he was assigned to a summit party, and on May 16th he reached the top without supplemental oxygen. 5 months after his Everest climb, Lobsang summited Cho Oyu with a Japanese team. In the spring of 1994, he worked for Fisher on the Sagarmatha Environmental Expedition and reached the top of Everest a second time, again without bottled oxygen. The following September, he was attempting the West Ridge of Everest with a Norwegian team when he was hit by an avalanche. After tumbling 200 feet down the mountain, he somehow managed to arrest his fall with an ice axe, thereby saving the lives of himself and two rope mates, but an uncle who wasn't tied to the others, Mingma Norbu Sherpa, was swept to his death. Although the loss rocked Lobsang hard, it didn't diminish his ardor for climbing. In May 1995, he summited Everest a third time without using gas, on this occasion as an employee of Hall's expedition, and 3 months later he climbed 26,400-foot Broad Peak in Pakistan while working for Fisher. By the time Lobsang went to Everest with Fisher in 1996, he'd only been climbing for 3 years, but in that span he'd participated in no fewer than 10 Himalayan expeditions and had established a reputation as a high-altitude mountaineer of the highest caliber. Climbing together on Everest in 1994, Fisher and Lobsang grew to admire each other immensely. Both men had boundless energy, irresistible charm, and a knack for making women swoon. Regarding Fisher as a mentor and role model, Lobsang even started wearing his hair in a ponytail, as Fisher did. "Scott is very strong guy. I am very strong guy," Lobsang explained to me with characteristic immodesty. "We make good team. Scott does not pay me as well as Rob or Japanese, but I no need money. I am looking to future, and Scott is my future. He tell to me, 'Lobsang, my strong Sherpa, I making you famous. I think Scott has many big plans for me with Mountain Madness.'" Chapter 10. Lhotse Face. April 29, 1996. 23,400 feet. The American public had no inherent national sympathy for mountain climbing, unlike the Alpine countries of Europe or the British who had invented the sport. In those countries, there was something akin to understanding, and though the man in the street might on the whole consider it a reckless risk to life, he acknowledged that it was something that had to be done. There was no such acceptance in America. Walt Unsworth, Everest. A day after our first attempt to reach Camp 3 was thwarted by wind and barbarous cold, everybody on Hall's team except Doug, who stayed at Camp 2 to let his injured larynx heal, made another try. 1,000 feet up the immense slant of the Lhotse Face, I ascended a faded nylon rope that seemed to go on forever, and the higher I got, the more laggardly I moved. I slid my Jumar up the fixed line with a gloved hand, rested my weight on the device to draw 2 burning, labored breaths. Then I moved my left foot up and stamped the crampon into the ice, desperately sucked in another 2 lungfuls of air, planted my right foot next to my left, inhaled and exhaled from the bottom of my chest, inhaled and exhaled again, and slid the Jumar up the rope one more time. I'd been exerting myself at full bore for the past 3 hours, and I expected to be at it for at least an hour more before taking a rest. In this agonizing fashion, I climbed toward a cluster of tents reputed to be perched somewhere on the sheer face above, progressing in increments calibrated in inches. People who don't climb mountains, the great majority of humankind, that is to say, tend to assume that the sport is a reckless Dionysian pursuit of ever-escalating thrills. But the notion that climbers are merely adrenaline junkies chasing a righteous fix is a fallacy, at least in the case of Everest. What I was doing up there had almost nothing in common with bungee jumping or skydiving or riding a motorcycle at 120 miles per hour. Above the comforts of base camp, the expedition, in fact, became an almost Calvinistic undertaking. The ratio of misery to pleasure was greater by an order of magnitude than any other mountain I'd been on. I quickly came to understand that climbing Everest was primarily about enduring pain, and in subjecting ourselves to week after week of toil, tedium, and suffering, it struck me that most of us were probably seeking, above all else, something like a state of grace. Of course, for some Everesters, myriad other, less virtuous motives came into play as well. Minor celebrity, career advancement, ego massage, ordinary bragging rights, filthy lucre. But such ignoble enticements were less a factor than many critics might presume. Indeed, what I observed as the weeks went by forced me to substantially revise my presuppositions about some of my teammates. Take Beck Weathers, for instance, who at the moment appeared as a tiny red speck on the ice 500 feet below, near the end of a long queue of climbers. My first impression of Beck had not been favorable, a back-slapping Dallas pathologist with less than mediocre mountaineering skills. At first blush, he came across as a rich Republican blowhard looking to buy the summit of Everest for his trophy case. Yet the better I got to know him, the more he earned my respect. Even though his inflexible new boots had chewed his feet into hamburger, Beck kept hobbling upward day in and day out, scarcely mentioning what must have been horrific pain. He was tough, driven, stoic, and what I initially took to be arrogance was looking more and more like exuberance. The man seemed to bear no ill will toward anybody in the world, Hillary Clinton notwithstanding. Beck's cheer and limitless optimism were so winning that, in spite of myself, I grew to like him a lot. The son of a career Air Force officer, Beck had spent his childhood shuttling from one military base to another before landing in Wichita Falls to attend college. He graduated from medical school, got married and had 2 children, settled comfortably into a lucrative Dallas practice. Then, in 1986, pushing 40, he took a vacation in Colorado, felt the siren song of the heights, and enrolled in a rudimentary mountaineering course in Rocky Mountain National Park. It is not uncommon for doctors to be chronic overachievers. Beck wasn't the first physician to go overboard with a new hobby. But climbing was unlike golf or tennis or the various other pastimes that consumed his cronies. The demands of mountaineering, the physical and emotional struggles, the very real hazards, made it more than just a game. Climbing was like life itself, only it was cast in much sharper relief, and nothing had ever hooked Beck to such a degree. His wife, Peach, became increasingly concerned about his immersion and the way climbing robbed their family of his presence. She was less than pleased when, not long after taking up the sport, Beck announced that he'd decided to have a go at the 7 summits. Selfish and grandiose though Beck's obsession may have been, it wasn't frivolous. I began to recognize a similar seriousness of purpose in Lou Kosciuszko, the lawyer from Bloomfield Hills, in Yasuko Namba, the quiet Japanese woman who ate noodles every morning for breakfast, and in John Taskey, the 56-year-old anesthesiologist from Brisbane who took up climbing after retiring from the Army. "When I left the military, I sort of lost my way," Taskey bemoaned in a thick Aussie accent. He'd been a big deal in the Army, a full bird colonel in the Special Air Service, Australia's equivalent of the Green Berets. Having served 2 tours in Vietnam at the height of the war, He found himself woefully unprepared for the flat pitch of life out of uniform. "I discovered that I couldn't really speak to civilians," he continued. "My marriage fell apart. All I could see was this long, dark tunnel closing in, ending in infirmity, old age, and death. Then I started to climb, and the sport provided most of what had been missing for me in Civvy Street, the challenge, the camaraderie, the sense of mission. As my sympathy for Tasky, Weathers, and some of my other teammates mounted, I felt increasingly uncomfortable in my role as a journalist. I had no qualms when it came to writing frankly about Hall, Fisher, or Sandy Pittman, each of whom had been aggressively seeking media attention for years. But my fellow clients were a different matter. When they signed up with Hall's expedition, none of them had known that a reporter would be in their midst, scribbling constantly, quietly recording their words and deeds in order to share their foibles with a potentially unsympathetic public. After the expedition was over, Weathers was interviewed for the television program Turning Point. In a segment of the interview that wasn't included in the version edited for broadcast, ABC News anchor Forrest Sawyer asked Beck, "How do you feel about a reporter being along?" Beck replied, "It added a lot of stress. I was always a little concerned with the idea, you know, this guy's going to come back and write a story that's going to be read by a couple of million people. And I mean, it's bad enough to go up there and make a fool of yourself if it's just you and the climbing group. That somebody may have you written across the pages of some magazine as a buffoon and a clown has got to play upon your psyche as to how you perform, how hard you'll push. And I was concerned that it might drive people further than they wanted to go. And it might even for the guides. I mean, they want to get people on top of the mountain because, once again, they're going to be written about, and they're going to be judged." A moment later, Sawyer asked, "Did you sense that having a reporter along put extra pressure on Rob Hall?" Beck answered, "I can't imagine it didn't. This is what Rob does for a living, and if one of his clients got injured, that's the worst thing that can happen to a guide. He certainly had a great season 2 years before this in which they got everybody on top of the summit, which is extraordinary, and I actually think that he thought that our group was strong enough that we could repeat that. So I think there is a push so that when you wind up again in the news, in the magazine, it's all reported favorably." It was late in the morning by the time I finally humped into Camp 3, a trio of small yellow tents halfway up the vertiginous sprawl of the Lhotse face, jammed side by side onto a platform that had been hewn from the icy slope by our Sherpas. When I arrived, Lakpa Chiri and Arita were still hard at work on a platform for a fourth tent, so I took off my pack and helped them chop. At 24,000 feet, I could manage only 7 or 8 blows of my ice axe before having to pause for more than a minute to catch my breath. My contribution to the effort was negligible, needless to say, and it took nearly an hour to complete the job. Our tiny camp, 100 feet above the tents of the other expeditions, was a spectacularly exposed perch. For weeks we'd been toiling in what amounted to a canyon. Now, for the first time on the expedition, the vista was primarily sky rather than earth. Herds of puffy cumulus raced beneath the sun, imprinting the landscape with a shifting matrix of shadow and blinding light. Waiting for my teammates to arrive, I sat with my feet hanging over the abyss, staring across the clouds, looking down on the tops of 22,000-foot peaks that a month earlier had towered overhead. At long last, it seemed as though I was really nearing the roof of the world. The summit, however, was still a vertical mile above, wreathed in a nimbus of gale-borne condensation. But even as the upper mountain was raked by winds in excess of 100 miles per hour, the air at Camp 3 barely stirred, and as the afternoon wore on, I began to feel increasingly woozy from the fierce solar radiation. At least I hoped it was the heat that was making me stupid, and not the onset of cerebral edema. High-altitude cerebral edema, HACE, is less common than high-altitude pulmonary edema, HAPE, but it tends to be even more deadly. A baffling ailment, HACE occurs when fluid leaks from oxygen-starved cerebral blood vessels, causing severe swelling of the brain, and it can strike with little or no warning. As pressure builds inside the skull, motor and mental skills deteriorate with alarming speed, typically within a few hours or less, and often without the victim even noticing the change. The next step is coma, and then, unless the afflicted party is quickly evacuated to lower altitude, death. Haste happened to be on my mind that afternoon because just 2 days earlier, a client of Fisher's named Dale Cruz, a 44-year-old dentist from Colorado, had come down with a serious case of it right here at Camp 3. A longtime friend of Fisher's, Cruz was a strong, very experienced climber. On April 26th, he'd climbed from Camp 2 to Camp 3, brewed some tea for himself and his teammates, and then lay down in his tent to take a nap. "I fell right asleep," Cruz recalls, "and ended up sleeping almost 24 hours, until about 2 p.m. the following day. When somebody finally woke me up, it immediately became apparent to the others that my mind wasn't working, although it wasn't apparent to me. Scott told me, 'We gotta get you down right away.'" Cruz was having an incredibly difficult time simply trying to dress himself. He put his climbing harness on inside out, threaded it through the fly of his windsuit, and failed to fasten the buckle. Fortunately, Fisher and Neil Beidelman noticed the screw-up before Cruz started to descend. "If he'd tried to rappel down the ropes like that," says Beidelman, "he would have immediately popped out of his harness and fallen to the bottom of the Lhotse face." "It was like I was very drunk," Cruz recollects. "I couldn't walk without stumbling and completely lost the ability to think or speak. It was a really strange feeling. I'd have some word in my mind, but I couldn't figure out how to bring it to my lips. So Scott and Neil had to get me dressed and make sure my harness was on correctly. Then Scott lowered me down the fixed ropes." By the time Cruz arrived in base camp, he says, "It was still another 3 or 4 days before I could walk from my tent to the mess tent without stumbling all over the place." When the evening sun slid behind Pumori, the temperature at Camp 3 plummeted more than 50 degrees, and as the air chilled, my head cleared. My anxiety about coming down with haste proved to be unfounded, at least for the time being. The next morning, after a miserable, sleepless night at 24,000 feet, we descended to Camp 2, and a day later, on May 1st, continued down to base camp to recoup our strength for the summit push. Our acclimatization was now officially complete, and to my pleasant surprise, Hall's strategy appeared to be working. After 3 weeks on the mountain, I found that the air at base camp seemed thick and rich and voluptuously saturated with oxygen compared to the brutally thin atmosphere of the camps above. All was not well with my body, however. I'd lost nearly 20 pounds of muscle mass, largely from my shoulders, back, and legs. I'd also burned up virtually all my subcutaneous fat, making me vastly more sensitive to the cold. My worst problem, though, was my chest. The dry hack I'd picked up weeks earlier in Lobje had gotten so bad that I'd torn some thoracic cartilage during an especially robust bout of coughing at Camp 3. The coughing had continued unabated, and each hack felt like a stiff kick between the ribs. Most of the other climbers in base camp were in similarly battered shape. It was simply a fact of life on Everest. In 5 days, those of us on Hall's and Fisher's teams would be leaving base camp for the top. Hoping to staunch my decline, I resolved to rest, gobble ibuprofen, and force down as many calories as possible in that time. From the beginning, Hall had planned that May 10th would be our summit day. "Of the 4 times I've summited," he explained, "twice it was on the 10th of May. As the Sherpas would put it, the 10th is an auspicious date for me." But there was also a more down-to-earth reason for selecting this date. The annual ebb and flow of the monsoon made it likely that the most favorable weather of the year would fall on or near May 10th. For all of April, the jet stream had been trained on Everest like a fire hose, blasting the summit pyramid with hurricane-force winds. Even on days when base camp was perfectly calm and flooded with sunshine, an immense banner of wind-driven snow flew from the summit. But in early May, we hoped, the approach of the monsoon from the Bay of Bengal would force the jet stream north into Tibet. If this year was like past years, between the departure of the wind and the arrival of the monsoon storms, we would be presented with a brief window of clear, calm weather, during which a summit assault would be possible. Unfortunately, the annual weather pattern was no secret, and every expedition had set their sights on the same window of fair weather. Hoping to avoid dangerous gridlock on the summit ridge, Hall held a big powwow with leaders of the other expeditions in base camp. It was determined that Goran Kropp, a young Swede who had ridden a bicycle from Stockholm to Nepal, would make the first attempt, alone, on May 3rd. Next would be a team from Montenegro. Then, on May 8th or 9th, it would be the turn of the IMAX expedition. Hall's team, it was decided, would share a summit date of May 10th with Fisher's expedition. After nearly getting killed by a falling rock low on the southwest face, Peter Naby, the solo Norwegian climber, was already gone. He'd quietly left base camp one morning and returned to Scandinavia. A guided group led by Americans Todd Burleson and Pete Athens, as well as Mal Duff's commercial team and another British commercial team, all promised to steer clear of May 10th, as did the Taiwanese. Ian Woodall, however, declared that the South Africans would go to the top whenever they damn well pleased, probably on May 10th, and anyone who didn't like it could bugger off. Hall, ordinarily extremely slow to rile, flew into a rage when he learned of Woodall's refusal to cooperate. "I don't want to be anywhere near the upper mountain when those punters are up there," he seethed. Chapter 11. Base Camp, May 6, 1996. 17,600 feet. How much of the appeal of mountaineering lies in its simplification of interpersonal relationships, its reduction of friendship to smooth interaction, like war, its substitution of an other, the mountain, the challenge, for the relationship itself? Behind a mystique of adventure, toughness, footloose vagabondage, all much-needed antidotes to our culture's built-in comfort and convenience, may lie a kind of adolescent refusal to take seriously aging, the frailty of others, interpersonal responsibility, weakness of all kinds, the slow and unspectacular course of life itself. Top climbers can be deeply moved, in fact maudlin, but only for worthy martyred ex-comrades. A certain coldness, strikingly similar in tone, emerges from the writings of Buell, John Harlan, Bonatti, Bonington, and Haston, the coldness of competence. Perhaps this is what extreme climbing is about, to get to a point where, in Haston's words, if anything goes wrong, it will be a fight to the end. If your training is good enough, survival is there. If not, nature claims its forfeit. David Roberts, Peti Agonistes, Moments of Doubt. We left base camp at 4:30 a.m. on May 6th to commence our summit bid. The top of Everest, 2 vertical miles above, seemed so impossibly distant that I tried to limit my thoughts to Camp 2, our destination for the day. By the time the first sunlight struck the glacier, I was at 20,000 feet in the maw of the Western Coom, grateful that the icefall was below me and that I would have to go through it only one more time on the final trip down. I had been plagued by heat in the Coom every time I'd traveled through it, and this trip was no exception. Climbing with Andy Harris at the front of the group, I continually stuffed snow under my hat and moved as fast as my legs and lungs would propel me, hoping to reach the shade of the tents before succumbing to the solar radiation. As the morning dragged on and the sun beat down, my head began to pound. My tongue swelled so much that it was difficult to breathe through my mouth, and I noticed that it was becoming harder and harder to think clearly. Andy and I dragged into Camp 2 at 10:30 a.m. After I guzzled 2 liters of Gatorade, my equilibrium returned. "It feels good to at last be on our way to the summit, yeah?" Andy inquired. He'd been laid low with various intestinal ailments for most of the expedition and was finally getting his strength back. A gifted tutor blessed with astonishing patience, he'd usually been assigned to watch over the slower clients at the back of the herd, and was thrilled when Rob had turned him loose this morning to go out on point. As the junior guide on Hall's team, and the only one who'd never been on Everest, Andy was eager to prove himself to his seasoned colleagues. "I think we're actually going to knock this big bastard off," he confided in me with a huge smile, staring up at the summit. As the junior guide on Hall's team, and the only one who'd never been on Everest, Andy was eager to prove himself to his seasoned colleagues.
"I think we're actually going to knock this big bastard off," he confided in me with a huge smile, staring up at the summit.
Later that day, Goran Kropp, the 29-year-old Swedish soloist, passed Camp 2 on his way down to base camp, looking utterly worked. On October 16, 1995, he had left Stockholm on a custom-built bicycle loaded with 240 pounds of gear, intending to travel round-trip from sea level in Sweden to the top of Everest entirely under his own power, without Sherpa support or bottled oxygen. It was an exceedingly ambitious goal, but Kropp had the credentials to pull it off. He'd been on 6 previous Himalayan expeditions and had made solo ascents of Broad Peak, Cho-Oyu, and K2. During the 8,000-mile bike ride to Kathmandu, he was robbed by Romanian schoolchildren and assaulted by a crowd in Pakistan. In Iran, an irate motorcyclist broke a baseball bat over Kropp's, fortunately, helmeted head. He'd nevertheless arrived intact at the foot of Everest in early April with a film crew in tow, and immediately began making acclimatization trips up the lower mountain. Then on Wednesday, May 1st, he departed base camp for the top. Kropp reached his high camp at 26,000 feet on the South Col on Thursday afternoon and left for the top the following morning just after midnight. Everybody at base camp stayed close by their radios throughout the day, anxiously awaiting word of his progress. Helen Wilton hung a sign in our mess tent that read, "Go, Goran, go." For the first time in months, almost no wind blasted the summit, but the snow on the upper mountain was thigh-deep, making for slow, exhausting progress. Kropp bowled his way relentlessly upward through the drifts, however, and by 2 o'clock Thursday afternoon, he'd reached 28,700 feet, just below the south summit. But even though the top was no more than 60 minutes above, he decided to turn around, believing that he would be too tired to descend safely if he climbed any higher. "To turn around that close to the summit," Hall mused with a shake of his head on May 6th as Kropp plodded past Camp 2 on his way down the mountain. That showed incredibly good judgment on young Goran's part. "I'm impressed, considerably more impressed, actually, than if he'd continued climbing and made the top." Over the previous month, Rob had lectured us repeatedly about the importance of having a predetermined turnaround time on our summit day. In our case, it would probably be 1 p.m. or 2 at the very latest, and abiding by it no matter how close we were to the top. "With enough determination, any bloody idiot can get up this hill," Hall observed. "The trick is to get back down alive." Hall's easygoing facade masked an intense desire to succeed, which he defined in the fairly simple terms of getting as many clients as possible to the summit. To ensure success, he paid meticulous attention to detail: the health of the Sherpas, the efficiency of the solar-powered electrical system, the sharpness of his clients' crampons. Hall loved being a guide, and it pained him that some celebrated climbers, including but not limited to Sir Edmund Hillary, didn't appreciate how difficult guiding was, or give the profession the respect he felt it deserved. Rob decreed that Tuesday, May 7th, would be a rest day, so we got up late and sat around Camp 2, buzzing with nervous anticipation over the imminent summit assault. I fiddled with my crampons and some other gear, then tried to read a Carl Hiassen paperback, but was so focused on the climb that I kept scanning the same sentences over and over without the words registering. Eventually, I put the book down, snapped a few photos of Doug posing with a flag the Kent school kids had asked him to carry up the peak, and pumped him for detailed information about the difficulties of the summit pyramid, which he remembered well from the year before. "By the time we get to the top," he frowned, "I guarantee that you're going to be one hurtin' hombre." Doug was hell-bent on joining the summit push, even though his throat was still bothering him and his strength seemed to be at a low ebb. As he put it, "I've put too much of myself into this mountain to quit now, without giving it everything I've got." Late that afternoon, Fisher walked through our camp with a clenched jaw, moving uncharacteristically slowly toward his own tents. He usually managed to maintain a relentlessly upbeat attitude. One of his favorite utterances was, "If you're bumming out, you're not going to get to the top. So as long as we're up here, we might as well make a point of grooving. At the moment, however, Scott did not appear to be grooving in the slightest. Instead, he looked anxious and extremely tired. Because he'd encouraged his clients to move up and down the mountain independently during the acclimatization period, he ended up having to make a number of hurried, unplanned excursions between base camp and the upper camps when several clients experienced problems and needed to be escorted down. He'd already made special trips to assist Tim Madsen, Pete Schoening, and Dale Cruz. And now, on what should have been a badly needed day and a half of rest, Fisher had just been forced to make a hasty round trip from Camp 2 to base camp and back to help his good friend Cruz after he came down with what appeared to be a relapse of haze. Fisher had arrived at Camp 2 around noon the previous day, just after Andy and me, having climbed from base camp well ahead of his clients. He directed guide Anatoly Bukharev to bring up the rear, stay close to the group, and keep an eye on everybody. But Bukharev ignored Fisher's instructions. Instead of climbing with the team, he slept late, took a shower, and departed base camp some 5 hours behind the last of the clients. Thus, when Cruz collapsed at 20,000 feet with a splitting headache, Bukharev was nowhere in the vicinity, compelling Fisher and Beidelman to rush down from Camp 2 to handle the emergency as soon as word of Cruz's condition arrived via climbers coming up the western coombe. Not long after Fisher reached Cruz and began the troublesome descent to base camp, they encountered Bukharev at the top of the icefall ascending alone, and Fisher harshly reprimanded the guide for shirking his responsibilities. "Yeah," Cruz remembers, "Scott laid into Tolley pretty good. He wanted to know why he was so far behind everybody, why he wasn't climbing with the team." According to Cruz and other clients of Fisher's, tension between Fisher and Bukharev had been building throughout the expedition. Fisher paid Bukharev $25,000, an unusually generous fee for guiding Everest. Most other guides on the mountain were paid $10,000 to $15,000. Skilled climbing Sherpas received only $1,400 to $2,500. And Bukharev's performance hadn't been meeting his expectations. "Tolley was a very strong and very good technical climber," Cruz explains, "but he had poor social skills. He didn't watch out for other people. He just wasn't a team player. Earlier, I'd told Scott that I didn't want to have to climb with Tolley high on the mountain, because I doubted that I'd be able to count on him when it really mattered." The underlying problem was that Bukharev's notion of his responsibilities differed substantially from Fisher's. As a Russian, Bukharev came from a tough, proud, hardscrabble climbing culture that did not believe in coddling the weak. In Eastern Europe, guides were trained to act more like Sherpas, hauling loads, fixing ropes, establishing the route, and less like caretakers. Tall and blonde, with handsome Slavic features, Bukharev was one of the most accomplished high-altitude climbers in the world, with 20 years of experience in the Himalaya, including 2 ascents of Everest without supplemental oxygen. And in the course of his distinguished career, he'd formulated a number of unorthodox, very strongly held opinions about how the mountain should be ascended. He was quite outspoken in his belief that it was a mistake for guides to pamper their clients. "If client cannot climb Everest without big help from guide," Bukharev told me, "this client should not be on Everest. Otherwise, there can be big problems up high." But Bukharev's refusal or inability to play the role of a conventional guide in the Western tradition exasperated Fisher. It also forced him and Beidelman to shoulder a disproportionate share of the caretaker duties for their group, and by the first week in May, the effort had taken an unmistakable toll on Fisher's health. After arriving in base camp with the ailing Cruz on the evening of May 6th, Fisher made 2 satellite phone calls to Seattle, in which he complained bitterly to his business partner Karen Dickinson and to his publicist Jane Bromet about Bukharev's intransigence. Note: Bromet had left base camp in mid-April and returned to Seattle, whence she continued to file internet dispatches about Fisher's expedition for Outside Online. She relied on regular phone updates from Fisher as the primary source for her reports. End of note. Neither woman imagined that these would be the last conversations they would ever have with Fisher. On May 8th, both Hall's team and Fisher's team departed Camp 2 and commenced the grinding ascent of the ropes up the Lhotse face. 2,000 feet above the floor of the Western Coombe, just below Camp 3, a boulder the size of a small television came rocketing down from the cliffs above and smashed into Andy Harris's chest. It knocked him off his feet, slammed the wind out of him, and left him dangling from the fixed line in a state of shock for several minutes. Had he not been clipped in with a Jumar, he would have certainly fallen to his death. When he arrived at the tents, Andy looked badly rattled, but claimed that he wasn't injured. "I might be a bit stiff in the morning," he insisted, "but I think the bloody thing didn't do much more than bruise me." Just before the rock nailed him, he'd been hunched forward with his head down. He happened to look up a moment before it struck, so that it merely grazed his chin before hitting him in the sternum, but it had come sickeningly close to smashing into his cranium. "If that rock had hit me in the head," Andy speculated with a grimace as he shed his pack, leaving the rest of the sentence unsaid. Because Camp 3 was the only camp on the entire mountain that we didn't share with the Sherpas, the ledge was too small to accommodate tents for all of us, it meant that here we had to do our own cooking, which mostly amounted to melting prodigious quantities of ice for drinking water. Due to the pronounced dehydration that was an inevitable byproduct of heavy breathing in such desiccated air, each of us consumed more than a gallon of liquid every day. We therefore needed to produce approximately a dozen gallons of water to meet the needs of 8 clients and 3 guides. As the first person to reach the tents on May 8th, I inherited the job of ice chopper. For 3 hours, as my companions trickled into camp and settled into their sleeping bags, I remained outside hacking at the slope with the adze of my ice axe, filling plastic garbage bags with frozen shards, and distributing the ice to the tents for melting. At 24,000 feet, it was fatiguing work. Every time one of my teammates yelled, "Hey John, you still out there? We could use some more ice over here," it gave me a fresh perspective on how much the Sherpas ordinarily did for us, and how little we truly appreciated it. By late afternoon, as the sun eased toward the corrugated horizon and the temperature began to plunge, everyone had pulled into camp except Lou Kosicki, Frank Fishbeck, and Rob, who had volunteered to do the sweep and come up last. Around 4:30 p.m., guide Mike Groom received a call from Rob on his walkie-talkie. Lou and Frank were still a couple of 100 feet below the tents and moving extremely slowly. Would Mike please come down to assist them? Mike hurriedly put his crampons back on and disappeared down the fixed ropes without complaint. Nearly an hour passed before he reappeared, just ahead of the others. Lou, who was so tired he'd let Rob carry his pack, staggered into camp looking pale and distraught, muttering, "I'm finished. I'm finished. Completely out of gas." Frank showed up a few minutes later appearing even more exhausted, although he'd refused to give his pack to Mike. It was a shock to see these guys, both of whom had been climbing well lately, in such a state. Frank's apparent deterioration came as a particular blow. I'd assumed from the beginning that if any members of our team reached the top, Frank, who'd been high on the mountain 3 times previously and seemed so savvy and strong, would be among them. As darkness enveloped the camp, our guides handed out oxygen canisters, regulators, and masks to everyone. For the remainder of the climb, we would be breathing compressed gas. Relying on bottled oxygen as an aid to ascent is a practice that sparked acrimonious debate ever since the British first took experimental oxygen rigs to Everest in 1921. Skeptical Sherpas promptly dubbed the unwieldy canisters English Air. Initially, the foremost critic of bottled gas was George Lee Mallory, who protested that using it was unsporting and therefore un-British. But it soon became apparent that in the so-called death zone above 25,000 feet, without supplemental oxygen, the body is vastly more vulnerable to hape and haze, hypothermia, frostbite, and a host of other mortal perils. By 1924, when he returned for his 3rd expedition to the mountain, Mallory had become convinced that the summit would never be reached without gas, and he resigned himself to using it. Experiments conducted in decompression chambers had by then demonstrated that a human plucked from sea level and dropped on the summit of Everest, where the air holds only a third as much oxygen, would lose consciousness within minutes and die soon thereafter. But a number of idealistic mountaineers continued to insist that a gifted athlete blessed with rare physiological attributes, could, after a lengthy period of acclimatization, climb the peak without bottled oxygen. Taking this line of reasoning to its logical extreme, the purists argued that using gas was therefore cheating. In the 1970s, the famed Tyrolean alpinist Reinhold Messner emerged as the leading proponent of gasless climbing, declaring that he would ascend Everest by fair means or not at all. Shortly thereafter, he and his longtime partner, the Austrian Peter Hobler, astounded the world climbing community by making good on the boast. At 1 p.m. on May 8, 1978, they ascended to the summit via the South Col and Southeast Ridge route without using supplemental oxygen. It was hailed by climbers in some circles as the first true ascent of Everest. Messner and Hobler's historic deed was not greeted with hosannas in all quarters, however, especially among the Sherpas. Most of them simply refused to believe that Westerners were capable of such an achievement, which had eluded even the strongest Sherpas. Speculation was rampant that Messner and Hobler had sucked oxygen from miniature cylinders hidden in their clothing. Tenzing Norgay and other eminent Sherpas signed a petition demanding that the government of Nepal conduct an official inquiry of the purported ascent. But the evidence verifying the oxygenless climb was irrefutable. 2 years later, Messner silenced all doubters, moreover, by traveling to the Tibetan side of Everest and making another ascent sans gas, this time entirely alone, without the support of Sherpas or anybody else. When he reached the summit at 3 p.m. on August 20, 1980, climbing through thick clouds and falling snow, Messner said, "I was in continual agony. I have never in my whole life been so tired." In The Crystal Horizon, his book about the ascent, he described struggling up the final meters to the top. "When I rest, I feel utterly lifeless except that my throat burns when I draw breath. I can scarcely go on. No despair, no happiness, no anxiety. I have not lost the mastery of my feelings. There are actually no more feelings. I consist only of will. After each few meters, this too fizzles out in unending tiredness. Then I think nothing. I let myself fall, just lie there. For an indefinite time I remain completely irresolute. Then I make a few steps again." Upon Messner's return to civilization, his ascent was widely lauded as the greatest mountaineering feat of all time. After Messner and Hobler proved that Everest could be climbed without gas, a cadre of ambitious mountaineers agreed that it should be climbed without gas. Henceforth, if one aspired to be considered a member of the Himalayan elite, eschewing bottled oxygen was mandatory. By 1996, some 60 men and women had reached the summit without it, five of whom didn't make it back down alive. However grandiose some of our individual ambitions may have been, nobody on Hall's team ever really considered going for the summit without bottled oxygen. Even Mike Groom, who'd climbed Everest 3 years earlier without gas, explained to me that he intended to use it this time around because he was working as a guide, and he knew from experience that without bottled oxygen, he would be so severely impaired, both mentally and physically, that he would be unable to fulfill his professional duties. Like most veteran Everest guides, Groom believed that although it was acceptable, and indeed aesthetically preferable, to do without bottled oxygen when climbing on one's own, it would be extremely irresponsible to guide the peak without using it. The state-of-the-art Russian-built oxygen system used by Hall consisted of a stiff plastic oxygen mask of the sort worn by MiG fighter pilots during the Vietnam War, connected via a rubber hose and a crude regulator to an orange, steel, and Kevlar gas canister. Smaller and much lighter than a scuba tank, each one weighed 6.6 pounds when full. Although we hadn't slept with oxygen during our previous stay at Camp 3, now that we had begun the push to the summit, Rob strongly urged us to breathe gas through the night. "Every minute you remain at this altitude and above," he cautioned, "your minds and bodies are deteriorating." Brain cells were dying. Our blood was growing dangerously thick and sludge-like. Capillaries in our retinas were spontaneously hemorrhaging. Even at rest, our hearts beat at a furious rate. Rob promised that bottled oxygen will slow the decline and help you sleep. I tried to heed Rob's advice, but my latent claustrophobia prevailed. When I clamped the mask over my nose and mouth, I kept imagining that it was suffocating me. So, after a miserable hour, I took it off and spent the rest of the night without gas, breathlessly flopping and fidgeting, checking my watch every 20 minutes to see if it was time to get up yet.